And we return on this Monday afternoon, Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. It's today's topical currents. Well, this hour we reflect on the 2012 presidential race between, of course, incumbent Barack Obama and Republican challenger Mitt Romney. We have the co-authors of the book, The Gamble, Choice and Chance in the 2012 Presidential Election. First, it's political science professor John Sides of George Washington University, and he joins us from Virginia. Welcome to you, Mr. Sides.
Thank you very much.
And joining us from California is UCLA political science and communication professor Lynn Vavreck. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let me just ask you both, and either of you can answer, and actually that goes for most of my questions. You said you named the book The Gamble because you were taking a risk with your book along with your publisher and those who shared the data with you. What were the risks? Why was it a gamble?
It's one of the reasons we chose The Gamble, but not the only reason. But it certainly was a risk for us just to try to do the work that quickly. We wanted the work to be scientific, and nobody really does science in real time. So we knew we were going to have to work quickly, be able to accept mistakes if we made them and correct them quickly. And no one had ever really worked like this before. But it was also there were also other gambles in the electorate that we thought made the title relevant.
Okay.
Well, it's been more than a year and a half. Why did it have to be so quick?
If you look at the way in which commentary and journalists proceed, both during and in the wake of an election, I think that their perceptions and thus conventional wisdom, and in some sense the first drafts of history, are written very, very quickly. And so we felt that it was an important role for social scientists if we could be part of the conversation during an election, but then also work on the same timetable as journalists who are writing about the election and writing books about the election after the fact. So, you know, the fact that our book is published at the same time as, you know, Jonathan Alter's book and Richard Wolff's book and Dan Balz's book and now the new book by the authors of Game Change, you know, it just allows us to have a presence in that conversation. Otherwise, if we were working on a typically academic timeline, you know, you wouldn't be hearing from us until 2014 or 2015.
Right.
In the book, could you describe the money ball approach to politics? Of course, that term refers to small market teams competing in baseball.
I think the main way that we intend that term for our purposes is to rely on the use of data to understand what happened and why it happened. One of the innovations of Moneyball was that you're going to replace sort of gut instinct and impressions and anecdotes from baseball scouts with actual hard data on how baseball players achieved and use that data to make decisions about acquiring players. So for us, looking at a campaign, you know, what we're trying to do is to take information on 45,000 different voters, on over a million political ads, on 11,000 different news outlets, and use these data to tell stories about what happened and why it happened. And one of the contrasts between that approach and, let's say, that of a journalist who's working on a campaign book, you know, they are most likely relying on the accounts of people who worked on the campaign, insider gossip and things like that. And that kind of information is very valuable if you want to know, you know, why did the Obama campaign do this or why did the Romney campaign do that. But it's not as helpful for knowing whether those decisions actually had an impact on Election Day. And I think that's where our approach comes in.
So you wrote this as a serialized account, and you released some of these as e-chapters before the book's actual publication. Why did you do that? I know the challenges because it must have been such a time crunch and pressure, but why did you decide to do that?
It parallels, I think, the same reasons we wanted the book to come out as quickly as possible after the election. During the campaign, during the nominating process, and over the summer, when journalists are writing about all of those quote-unquote game-changing moments, we wanted to be a part of that conversation. And we knew, because we've studied, you know, modern campaigns in depth, that those kinds of game-changing moments are really rare. And so we knew that the reporters would be out there talking about them, the summer ad blitz, and how that was going to really shore up the election for Obama. And we wanted to be able to be there with data, analyzed, in print, peer-reviewed, and say, you know what? Romney answered almost every ad he put on the air, and this ad blitz really isn't moving public opinion all that much.
So were there any real game changers? You said the media said there were 68 of them, but were there? What were the game changers that you actually found?
Well, I would say that if we mean by game changer, we mean some event that moved the polls in a substantial way. I would say that the two most important ones were the Democratic Party convention and the first debate. I mean, those were really the only two moments at which you could see really, you know, striking, noticeable differences. But if by those events we mean, you know, if by game changer we mean, you know, events that determine the outcome of the election, you know, there are very few such moments. Perhaps even the first debate doesn't qualify as a game changer in that definition, because it narrowed, you know, Obama's lead, but it didn't necessarily, you know, vault Romney to be a clear front runner. You know, what that means is that we cross a lot of other things off the list, you know, even things that made a lot of news, like the 47% video. We don't
That's
find
what I was
that
going
that really
to ask you about that.
Don't find it had a big effect on people's perceptions of the candidates or on the polls. If it had any effect at all, you know, it might have been to sort of demoralize a small fraction of Republicans who went from being Romney supporters to being undecided, only to come back to Romney after the first debate. But I think one of the reasons why we were sort of skeptical about this idea of game changer is that a lot of the campaign is really a push and pull between two sides with lots of money and lots of ads and lots of the things that professional campaigns had. You know, in that context, it's really hard for a strategic decision by a campaign or a gaffe by a candidate to have some, you know, transforming effect on the race. What's likely to happen is that, you know, 1 week's events, if they have any impact at all, are going to be sort of overcome and outdone by the next week's events, and then so on and so forth throughout the campaign. And the net of all that is not necessarily strongly beneficial for one candidate or the other.
Could you analyze? Go ahead.
I was just going to say that we like to call most of those moments in the campaign game samers, not game changers.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Interesting.
Could you analyze the effectiveness of political polls and which ones are most reliable?
I think that, you know, if you look at all the range of polls from this year, you know, and you look and try to say, okay, what was it about those polls that made them reliable? It's actually very difficult to identify systematic features. You know, three of the polls that ended up being the most reliable, one was by the Pew Research Center and also the Washington Post. Those were two pollsters who were doing live interview phone polls with, you know, cell phone samples. And then you had, on the other hand, a fairly accurate poll was done by Public Policy Polling that does robo-polls with, you know, recorded voices. And then you also had relatively accurate results by YouGov, which is a firm that does only online polling. And so I don't necessarily think that there's any, you know, magic trick or special sauce that enables pollsters to get it right. You know, to me, there are two sort of important things about the polls from this particular year. One was that, on average, they got the election right. Now, despite all the challenges that pollsters face right now with declining response rates and so forth, if you believe the polls, Barack Obama was going to win on Election Day, and he did. And that's why all the polling aggregators, whether it be Pollster at the Huffington Post or Nate Silver, you know, they all got it right for that reason. The other striking thing was, if anything, the polls might have actually underestimated Barack Obama's margin of victory on average, which is a pretty striking thing, because obviously the claim that was made throughout the campaign was that the polls were skewed in Obama's favor. But if anything, unskewing the polls in 2012 would have meant actually a larger Democratic margin of victory.
You say that your models and data show that President Obama was favored as early as November 2011, in spite of the economy. So explain, you know, how that differed from what we were hearing.
Well, one of the things that's interesting for us is when we look at these presidential elections historically, we can see this very regular pattern that incumbent parties who hold the White House in growing economies, even slowly growing economies, are almost always reelected. And so when John and I sat down in the summer of 2011 and we said, okay, what's likely to happen in terms of, say, GDP growth over the next 6 months, we looked at a lot of people who were forecasting that, the economy, and they were forecasting growth, and they were forecasting enough growth that allowed us to say, if that is what happens, then Barack Obama, who actually was the actual incumbent, not just incumbent party, but he's the incumbent, the guy, he's likely to be reelected. And what's really, really hard sometimes to appreciate about this pattern is that it really does, the incumbent's share of the two-party vote on Election Day is much more connected to the real state of the economy, the change in GDP in the first 6 months, than it is to people's impressions of the economy. And this is a little bit where Romney got into trouble. He looked at public opinion polling, and he saw in the summer of 2011 that most people thought the economy had not improved. And so they said, this is our leverage point. This is what we're going to, this is where we're going to go. We're going to blame Obama for the fact that people don't think the economy's gotten better. And in fact, that outcome, that people's opinions about the economy, is less correlated historically with incumbent share of the two-party vote than the actual growth rate.
We're speaking with Lynn Vavreck, author and professor of political science and communications at UCLA, and John Sides, is an author and professor of political science at George Washington University, co-founder and contributor of themonkeycage.org. On today's Topical Currents, we'll come back and take a short break, come back, take some calls and your emails.
And it's today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we're joined by political science professors John Sides of George Washington University and also Lynn Vavreck from UCLA. The two of you are on opposite coast. How did you get together to produce this book, John?
Lynn and I have known each other for many years just because of working in political science circles, but also working on campaigns and elections. And we had discussed at one point working together on a big survey project that was going to be conducted during the election year. And then we had the idea that if we were going to be involved in a survey project that was going to give us all of these interesting data about voters, that maybe we should turn that into some kind of written product. And so, we decided to do it. And I think, at the end of the day, it probably would have been helpful to be a little closer together than 3,000 miles. But I'd say this, the time change alone, the three-hour time difference between Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles actually gave us a small advantage, which is that there were times when, I could hand off work to Lynn as I was going to bed, and she could continue to work, and I could pick it up again when I got up and she was in bed. And so we could almost work 24 hours continuously, which is what it felt like at times when we were trying to finish the book.
I'm thinking about all those scenes from the West Wing TV series. How accurate were those portrayals of a campaign, the ins and outs and the subtleties, Lynn?
Well, as with most television dramas, there's a bit of exaggeration there, a lot of things that you see happening on television and campaigns, actually do happen over the course of a long campaign. They just don't all happen, in 1 week or in 1 day. It is very important what happens at some big event and what the headline is from that event in the local paper and the national papers, and who's going to be on the bus and who's getting kicked off the bus and who wants to sit down and who's going to get 5 minutes with the candidate and how's that going to happen. And all of those things are, real pressure situations for the people covering the campaigns, but also the people running the campaigns and organizing these events. It is one of, I think, the most high-pressured environments that you can work in.
John,
I think the one thing I would add to that is that I think a dramatization like The West Wing, and to some extent you can see similar dramatizations in some journalistic books about campaigns, they're really focused on the highest-level strategists and a conversation among a very small group of people. But if you look at the Obama campaign or any political campaign as an organization, you can see that a lot of work's being done that is probably more valuable from the standpoint of winning votes, but absolutely not subject to the same kinds of soap opera. So we've been talking to a lot of people in the Obama campaign that worked doing, data and analytics and experiments and things like that. And, the kind of work they were doing was very high pressure, as Lynn described, but, it's not the kind of work that is lending itself to, you know, shouting matches and the kinds of things that you hear described. And that's to say nothing of the actual experience that voters have with a campaign, which is not, you know, what one strategist said to another strategist, but it's the person who comes and knocks on their door. And so it's one of the interesting things about sometimes reporting about campaigns is it's really reporting about an aspect of campaigns that's the farthest removed from actual voters. And if you wanted to understand the campaign from their point of view, you know, you wouldn't try to convince the David Axelrods and the Stuart Stevens of the world to dish gossip to you. You would actually, you know, get out there and walk the sidewalks with field workers and listen to them knock on doors and talk to actual voters.
We're speaking with political science professors John Sides from George Washington University and Lynn Vavreck from UCLA about their book, The Gamble, Choice and Chance in the 2012 Presidential Election. If you have questions for them, the number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org. Lynn, tell us the ways in which President Obama's campaign differed from and was more innovative than Mitt Romney's.
Well, I think that you can even make a broader claim than that in saying that the Obama campaign in 2012 was innovative and different from any other presidential campaign that had ever been run. And they had some real moments of brilliance. For me personally, and John and I have talked to a lot of the folks who were involved, I come away thinking that their biggest innovation was their ability to integrate data coming in from all those different streams of the campaign that John just talked about. Data from the field workers who were knocking on people's doors, who were making phone calls, data from where they were placing advertisements, data from the contributions that were coming in, from the emails they were sending. And they took all of this information, which in typical campaigns is really siloed, and they leveraged technology. And they said, we're going to, at the end of every day, we're going to get all these data into one place, and then we're going to use them to try to figure out how we're doing in the electorate as a whole and where we need to deploy resources tomorrow. And so they had this sort of real-time engine that was telling them, tomorrow you want to be focusing on this county or this part of this state. And that ability to integrate all that information, that is really an innovation in presidential campaigns and took a tremendous amount of effort and manpower. So I would say, for me, that's probably their biggest innovation. And John might have another one, or a different one, I should say.
I'd say the other thing that they were doing that was unusual was that they were actually leveraging experiments to figure out what worked and what did not work. Even, you know, doing these experiments even during the campaign itself.
What kind of experiments?
Well, so I think the biggest experiment that they did that has received only a little bit of media attention occurred in February of 2012. And what they wanted to figure out was, can we actually persuade voters to vote for Barack Obama? And the way they did that was to take a random sample of voters from the voter files in various states, most all the battleground states and a handful of other states. And then they had some voters receive a phone call from a volunteer, and then others received no such phone call. And so they spent, I think it was about 350,000 different calls were made by Obama volunteers, which is an extraordinary amount of effort to put into doing an experiment. You know, granted, it was fairly early in the election year, not quite yet crunch time, but still. So in the wake of this, they made phone calls to as many of these voters as they could reach, and they reached about 20,000 voters, some of whom had been called and some of whom hadn't been called. And what they were able to determine from this was that the phone call had increased support for Obama by about 4 points. Now, of course, a phone call in February 2012 is not going to be meaningful in November of 2012. It's probably long forgotten. But what they were able to do is now they had a measure of, okay, what kinds of people are going to be most persuaded? And they were able to build a model that said not just whether you were going to be likely to support Romney or likely to support Obama or somewhere in between, undecided or unsure, but actually whether you would be likely to be persuaded. Would you change your mind if you were given information? And so as the campaign went on and they were using various kinds of targeting to figure out where to put resources, they had models not just of what you thought, but about this model of whether you would change your mind. And they think that allowed them to deploy their resources more efficiently. And this is the kind of Moneyball campaigning that is directly analogous to what baseball teams are doing when they're trying to use data to get the best players for the least money.
Our telephone number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. And also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. First caller, we've got Dwight. He's in Pembroke Pines. Hi there.
Hi, everyone. I'd like to make a comment. First of all, I'd like to say I got a lot of respect for the political sciences. I cannot even imagine the type of variables that have been introduced now with this new campaign finance laws. It is really just a free-for-all nowadays. And in fact, it's almost analogous to a high-stakes poker game, to where the audience sees the player's cards and are just yelling what the hands are. I don't even think the candidates have any control now any longer. And what this is doing is, I think it's going to change the dynamics now. Just as an example, you know, given, you know, just Republicans taking control of the mic, really they sunk their own ship in a lot of cases. And I don't think that the new paradigm is voting for candidates. I think it's voting against the other candidates. It mobilizes these huge bases that would probably have never voted in the first place. I can't imagine that the local turnouts in Miami-Dade and Broward are very low for the local elections, and I just can't imagine that people would put that much fervor into the national election just on the point of, hey, we can't have those other guys in the office. You know,
John Sides, could you comment on this?
Sure. Thanks for your comments, Dwight. I think two things about what you said struck me is a pretty accurate summary of kind of where campaigns stand. One is that you've got, like, as you said, this change in campaign finance law, and one of the things that's helped to do is to facilitate the flow of dollars from independent groups into the election. And clearly that was important in 2012. Mitt Romney would have been outraised by Obama by, several hundred million dollars had it not been the case that there were outside groups spending money on his behalf. Now, but most of the dollars that these outside groups were spending was to do precisely what you described, which was to convince people to vote against Obama as much as to vote for Romney. So the criticisms of Obama from these groups were pretty prevalent. Almost all advertising by independent groups in elections is negative advertising, whereas candidates are usually using a mixture of positive and negative messages. And in our survey data, one of the things that we're able to observe is precisely this kind of polarization process, where if you were undecided at the beginning of the campaign, let's say at the beginning of 2012, but you were a Democrat, one of the things that happened over the course of the campaign is that you came to like Barack Obama a little bit more, but you came to like Mitt Romney a lot less. And that enabled you as a Democrat to sort of return home to the flock where you belong and to vote for Barack Obama. And the same thing was true on the Republican side, except for the Republicans is actually a little bit more helping them learn to like Romney than it was helping them learn to dislike Obama. They already disliked Obama, but these undecided Republicans did learn to support Romney and to feel more favorably about him as the campaign went on.
Did you do any research on the impact of negative ads? I mean, do they work?
You know, we
Lynn?
Did not. we did not explicitly look at the effect of negative ads. It's one of those things that if we had had more time, if we had had probably another 6 months, we could have really pulled apart the advertising data in this kind of way. But these data are incredibly difficult to wield. And for this election, we have not done that work. But more generally, political scientists have changed their tune a little bit on attack advertising. At first, there was this thought that it demobilized people and turned them off from the process of voting. And then there was this counter argument that it actually increased people's interest, because information in attack ads is often vitriolic. It makes people pay attention, and it tends to have more issue advertising. More issue positions are stated, I should say, in an attack ad than in a positive promotional ad. So there are all these findings that show people actually learn more from attack advertising about the candidates than they do from promotional advertising. So it's a bit of a funny thing. People say they hate it. They, say it's distasteful. But they actually deliver a lot of information.
We need to take another break. We're speaking with political science professors John Sides from George Washington University and Lynn Vavreck from UCLA. And the name of their book is The Gamble, Choice and Chance in the 2012 Presidential Election. Short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, and we're joined by John Sides and Lynn Vavreck. They're both political scientists, and they've collaborated on the book, The Gamble, Choice and Chance in the 2012 Presidential Election. We've got a clear phone board. If you'd like to get in with a comment or a question, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN, email, that's radio at WLRN.org.
We have an emailer, David in North Miami Beach. I don't know if this is within your purview. He asks why Nate Silver thinks the congressional map is relevant since 48 states are still winner-take-all electoral votes. And I'll give that to John.
Sorry, why Nate Silver thinks that the
congressional map is still relevant since 48 states are still winner-take-all electoral votes.
I think maybe the emailer might have watched yesterday's ABC News This Week segment that Nate did, where he talked about the fact that if we look at presidential vote at the congressional level, Romney does quite well. And so I think that the point Nate is making there is not about presidential elections, which is, I think, where what the emailer is asking. Like, what does this have to do with the presidential mm-hmm. elections? It, in fact, does not. I think that comment was made to illuminate what's likely to happen in next year's midterm election.
Okay.
So if we use 2012 as an indicator of public opinion in those congressional districts, then that's likely to say, hey, Romney did well, and so Republicans in those districts next year will probably do well.
What did you mean when you said that, I'm sorry, Romney did as well as he could, but he was disadvantaged by the structural conditions from the start? What does that mean?
That's basically echoing back to the conversation we had a couple minutes ago about the state of the economy.
Okay.
So when we say structural conditions, we mean the state of the nation's economy, and what's the prediction there?
I see.
Was Obama's 52.9% a surprise to most people, most experts?
It was not a surprise to, I think, most experts. If you looked at the various political science forecasts, on average, those forecasts suggested that he was more likely to win than lose. There were a few models that forecast a Romney victory, but taken together, the forecasts certainly suggested he was likely to win. And again, anyone that was looking at polls and averaging polls, unless you came in with a sort of an ironclad faith that the polls were skewed, anybody averaging the polls was coming to the same conclusion. What was striking to me was that there was certainly a lot of resistance to that idea. You saw resistance, of course, in the Romney campaign. And one of the interesting things that we talk about in our book, which I think is one of the few gossipy tidbits that we reveal in the book, was that there were internal simulations inside the Romney campaign using the public polls that were similar in spirit to those that Nate Silver and others were doing. And, internal to the Romney campaign on the day before election day, those simulations were saying that at best Romney had maybe an 18% chance of winning. So the problem in the campaign was not so much that their data was wrong or that their analysis was wrong. It was that they were substituting for the numbers and for the analysis other kinds of beliefs about the way in which the campaign would turn out. So, for example, we heard this ourselves, and we also heard this from the Romney campaign, that people were going out into the field and going to rallies. They'd go to the rally, and they'd see several thousand people turn up and to cheer on Romney, and they'd come back to the campaign headquarters in Boston and say, you got to see these rallies. It just doesn't feel like a losing campaign. And the word feel there is, I think, fairly telling, because it suggests that, in some sense, these people were thinking like the old-school baseball scouts in the Moneyball book and movie. They're relying on some kind of gut instinct that's kind of unconnected from good objective systematic analysis, but the analysis was telling them something different. I think some of that same confusion, you know, certainly existed in punditry. Right-leaning pundits, I think, again, made a variety of mistakes, some of them. But even sometimes mainstream journalists would come away from all of this, and they would sort of throw up their hands and say, oh, no one knows. No one could know how this election is going to turn out. And they were saying this, you know, a week before Election Day when the polls were fairly clear, and it's very unusual for polls to change in that last week. And I think, to some extent, the partisan back and forth about the polls and all the debates about skewing and unskewing, you know, might have clouded some pundits' judgment, too.
How have traditional journalists responded to your book or to your work in general? And I'll ask you, Lynn.
We've had a really good conversation with the national political reporters and a number of local reporters who have covered the campaign. And we started very early and decided that we wanted to do some on-the-ground reporting ourselves, and we went to a number of those Republican debates in the fall of 2011, spent a little bit of time with some of the Republican candidates going around to their rallies and fundraisers with them, and then hit the ground in Iowa and New Hampshire, and it was really there where we met a lot of the reporters. Those, as you guys know, are, that's sort of ground zero for all political reporting about the campaign, those first two nominating contests. And we were really, you know, we've never done that before. And all of these reporters really helped us out. Yeah, and they took us and they said, you know, come with us, you know, come to this rally with us. And they welcomed us into the community, which was really, it was just really unexpected and great for us.
Why don't we take our normal break, Paul, and we'll get things back under control, okay? And it is today's Topical Currents. Thanks to our technical crew, we have both our guests with us, both our political science professors, Lynn Vavreck of UCLA, and also John Sides of George Washington University. Now, Bonnie, where were we?
Where were we? We were talking actually about, I had asked you about how journalists have responded to your work, and Lynn was speaking. And did you mention Iowa?
I did.
So you said that while the media was fixating on one candidate after another, Romney was well positioned to nab the nomination by the eve of the Iowa caucus. So why were they so misinformed, according to your data?
Well, I think the important thing to remember here is that John and I were engaged in a very specific mission. Who is going to be the Republican nominee, and then who is going to win the 2012 election? That's our job, that's our goal, to explain that process. The reporters who are in Iowa, in Des Moines, in Manchester, New Hampshire, their job is very different from that. In that moment, their job, in one sense, is to reflect the reality that is playing out in front of them. And so they need to write about the fact that Santorum is surging, that it was a tie in Iowa. Where we can look past that and say, does that moment tell us anything about who is likely to be the eventual nominee? And again, drawing on a lot of historical information about the nominating process, John and I were able to say, given what we've seen in these two early states, it'd be very hard for anyone to come up and beat Romney for the nomination. Now, a reporter can't write that story every day for 90 days until Romney gets that nomination, right? That's not his or her job.
And we'll take a caller. We've got Carlton in Miami. Hi there. Thanks for your patience.
Yeah, no problem. Good afternoon. Hello to your guests. They indicated that views on negative advertising have changed and that, in fact, political scientists now believe that people earn a lot from negative advertising. The question is, what happens when there is such an increase in misleading ads and some of them playing out false advertising or wrong advertising? How does that wrong information impact the elections?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think that one of the things that we have to say is that the 2012 election is this specific situation in which both sides had a lot of money and were able to advertise a lot, whether we're talking about just the candidates or the candidates plus their groups. And in a situation like that, where, let's say, there's a lot of attack advertising, and then a lot of it becomes misleading or encourages voters to draw a misleading inference, let's say. And the reason I make that distinction is that one of the things we know also limits the quote-unquote lying in advertisements is the good work that journalists do on these ad watches, where they're fact-checking all of the claims made in these ads. That actually has reduced the number of blatantly untrue things people say. But advertising is a really unique environment, and the way that the ads are made, people can come to a misleading conclusion without there actually being a misleading fact. So one of the things in a highly contested election is that that information is likely to get corrected by the other side. And so it's just a matter of, if you take a place like Florida, you know, for goodness sake, you're getting bombarded with advertisements, and you're getting them from both sides. And so you're really in a situation where you are exposed to both sides, maybe the potentially misleading information, but also the corrective.
Okay.
John, would you like to add to that?
I think it's a very hard issue in elections. You know, it's going to be harder to lie about, you know, a tube of toothpaste that you're selling than it is to lie about the person that might become the next leader of the free world. You know, there's lots of limits on whether companies and manufacturers can and make claims about their products, but the same doesn't exist for political candidates. You know, if there's one maybe piece of good news in addition to what Lynn mentioned about ad watches, you know, it is true that ads contain a lot of misinformation, but by and large, you know, what that misinformation is doing is mostly reinforcing the opinions that people already had about the candidates or about the political parties. So the fact that so many Americans identify with or lean towards a political party and, you know, tend to vote loyally for that party and use their partisanship as a lens through which they see the world. It's not the ideal way to see the world, don't get me wrong. It leads to all kinds of biases and the like. But what it does mean is if, you know, the candidates are peddling misinformation, that, you know, if it's the Democrat that's peddling the misinformation, well, Democrats will believe it because the Democrat's saying it, and Republicans will not believe it because it's the Democrat saying it. And so no one's being persuaded really one way or the other. And so in that sense, you know, there some of the effects of misinformation might be limited. That's not to suggest that it's not a problem or that we shouldn't ask more from electoral politics than we're actually getting. It's just to say that I'm not, you know, at the end of the day, it may not be the case that misinformation is you know, sort of producing a winner that shouldn't have won or something as dramatic as that.
What about independent voters? Are their legions rising or declining?
If you look at the percentage of people who say that they identify as independent, that percentage has been rising over time. But that is a misleading statistic. It conceals a lot of people who say that they're independent when you initially ask them. But when you follow up and ask them whether they lean towards a party, most of them will say that they lean towards a party. And then if you look to see how they behave in terms of politics and voting, they actually behave quite similarly to people who said they were partisans to begin with. So I think that we should not overestimate the fraction of voters that are actually truly independent. One of the other interesting things in the book that comes out of some analysis that Lynn did back in the summer of 2012 has to do with undecided voters, which everyone knows are a relatively small number of voters in any given election. But one of the things that Lynn was also able to show is that even this group of voters, the majority of them identify with or lean towards a political party. You know, we have this idea that undecided voters or swing voters are all political independents, but they're not. And this actually also helped us, you know, I think come up with some reasonable forecasts about the way the election was going to turn out, because you can predict, as I was describing earlier, that these voters would end up in the camp that they're naturally aligned with from the beginning. It just takes them a little bit longer to get there.
How else has the undecided voter been inaccurately portrayed? I mean, what other findings do you have about the undecided voter?
Well, I'd say, you know, John hit on the most surprising one, that a good number of them actually have a party identification. I would say the other thing that, you know, people like to the Saturday Night Live skit comes to everyone's mind. You know, who is the president, and is he or she standing for, you know, that they just know nothing. It is the case that they know less than people who make up their minds early. Now, what we don't want to do is rush to the conclusion that means that they don't know anything, right? If they knew where they stood on, you know, immigration or on healthcare reform, they probably would have made up their minds. So it isn't so much that they don't know where they stand on a lot of issues because they haven't engaged. It could very well be that they don't know because they have a lot of uncertainty about what the right way forward is. So, you know, there's a little bit of this caricature that happens. And I, you know, half of these undecided voters won't show up on election day. That's, you know, election after election, you know, that's pretty clear. So half of them are just not ever going to make up their mind. They're going to stay home, you know, which you might say is kind of a good thing. And the other half will, as John said, eventually engage in the same kind of process, weighing their party identification, weighing their general attitudes about things. But those things are just going to play a little bit of a less role than they play for partisans who make up their mind a year out.
Let's squeeze in another call. I've got Arthur in Davie, and I'm short on time, Arthur, but hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
I think none of you have mentioned the famous knockout punch or the grand slam home run that occurred when the waiter or a slant bartender videotaped a meeting in Boca Raton, and Romney talked about the 47%.
No, we talked about that.
You did?
We touched on it early on, but...
But you can go ahead.
John, how about reviving that?
I'm happy to actually add a little bit more detail in response to this topic. One of the reasons why this video was thought to be so important was because it reinforced this caricature of Mitt Romney as being an out-of-touch plutocrat. But Lynn and I had actually been measuring people's attitudes towards this dimension of the candidates, you know, way back in beginning in January of 2012. So we would ask people, how well do the following terms describe the candidates? Cares about the poor, cares about the middle class, cares about the wealthy, cares about people like you. And on those questions, Romney had the advantage on cares about the wealthy, and Obama had the advantage on cares about the middle class and cares about people like you. But that advantage did not change during the campaign, and it did not move in the wake of that video, which suggests that, again, people's perceptions of Romney or Obama were already kind of locked in, and even something as dramatic as the revelations of that video didn't actually change those perceptions.
Yeah, that is pretty amazing. So do you, John and Lynn, have plans to do this all over again in 2016?
Well, I'll say it was definitely... professionally rewarding and engaging. We love teaching and we love doing these long, big research projects, but this kind of fast-paced work, I think both of us really enjoyed. We should credit all of the data providers who partnered with us to make it possible, YouGov, General Sentiment. It's unlikely that those companies are going to step up again and basically give us the kind of data they gave us in 2012. So we're not sure that we'd be able to do it again, but I think that we got a great response from the journalistic community and also from voters out there who were just interested in what we were doing. And, you know, we'd certainly like to do it again. But it was an expensive project. We just didn't have to pay for the data. We had these firms partner with us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's unclear whether we'd be able to do something like this again.
And we have links to the book on our Facebook page and also the WLRN.org
right,
website.
Right, the gamble2012.com. The name of the book is The Gamble, Choice, and Chance in the 2012 Presidential Election. Lynn Vavreck, author, professor of poli-sci and communications at UCLA, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And John Sides, author and professor of poli-sci at George Washington University, co-founder of themonkeycage.org. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
And thank you for choosing Public Radio. Our producer, Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Also thanks to Lorenzo Ponce de Leon. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and previous programs at our website, WLRN.org. More information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. And tomorrow we have independent journalist Dan Ricker and Dan Christensen with open phones about regional issues and elections. taking calls. And on this day in 1879, 144 years ago, the birth of humorist and commentator Will Rogers in what is now Oklahoma. He of I never met a man I didn't like fame. Also a 1930s icon, he died in a 1938 Alaska air crash. And on this day in 1916, 97 years ago, the birth of news icon Walter Cronkite in St. Joseph, Missouri. He was a college dropout. The TV word anchor was first coined for his role in TV's maiden coverage of political conventions in 1952. One more while we say, there you go again. On this day in 1980, 33 years ago, Ronald Reagan routs incumbent Jimmy Carter by a 10% margin. Carter wins only two states, and Republicans control Congress for the first time in 25 years. So we leave with a thought from Will Rogers. Quote, the difference between a Republican and a Democrat is the Democrat is a cannibal. They have to live off each other. While Republicans, why, they live off the Democrats. Will Rogers was a great roper. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, stay tuned now for Here and Now, next from NPR News.